Welcome to the Culture of Things podcast with Brendan Rogers. This is a podcast where we talk all things culture, leadership and teamwork across business and sport.
To all our loyal listeners, the Culture of Things podcast will now have specific episodes produced for YouTube. To ensure you don't miss out on this exclusive YouTube content, head over to YouTube, click on the subscribe button, and hit the notification bell. Now, let's get into the episode.
As a person and as a leader, do you know what you stand for? My next guest definitely does. Ethical leadership is something he considers a unique point of difference. As he says, ethics is rare, and rare is valuable. Andrew Stotz is an impressive person with an impressive background. He's a former president of the Chartered Financial Analyst Society of Thailand and is one of Thailand's award-winning equity analysts. He's also the founder and CEO of A. Stotz Investment Research. He's authored 4 books, been a university lecturer in finance for more than 2 decades, and is co-founder of Coffee Works, which is Thailand's specialty coffee roaster. He's host of his own fantastic podcast called My Worst Investment Ever, where he's released 555 episodes and counting. And hot off the press, he's now the new host of the Deming Institute podcast called In Their Own Words. If you're watching on YouTube, I'd love you to watch the whole interview. I also understand you may want to check out a specific part. If that's the case, go to the chapters in the description below and choose the part you want to see. In the first half of the interview, Andrew explains the 5 key values that underpin how he interacts with people. In the second half, he explains the 5 key values that underpin how he does his work. He even links his last value, reveal conflicts, to how it can be used to reduce corruption. These 10 values, his ethics, are what guide him every day. As a leader, if you have this level of clarity in what you stand for, the right people will come into your world, and the wrong ones won't come near you. How many books have you read? I wonder if you've read as many as Andrew. He reveals the staggering amount during the interview, and he also touches on how his drug and alcohol addiction during his teenage years helped shape him and how he lives his values. After the interview, I share my 3 key takeaways. Share your takeaways with me via email, or you can put them in the YouTube comments. I hope you enjoy the interview. Let's get into it. Hello and welcome to the Culture Things podcast. I'm your host, Brendan Rogers, and this is episode 79. And today I get to talk to Andrew Stotz. Andrew, how are you, mate?
I'm good. How are you, Brendan?
Very well, mate. Very well. You're coming to us all the way from Bangkok today. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. As we talked earlier, it's always hot and steamy here in Bangkok.
Isn't it what? I was fortunate enough to spend a few weeks in Bangkok many, many years ago working for a shipping company. And I spent a fair bit of that time sweating, I have to say.
Yeah. I've gotten used to it. I used to be in dry climate back in the U.S., but I've really gotten used to that. And it's, you know, the way your skin feels and all that. So I'm used to the humidity.
You've acclimatized.
Absolutely.
Good on you, buddy. Mate, let's dive in. Tell us a bit about Andrew. You know, you've this financial background and an unbelievable background, actually. But don't go into your teenage side of things. That sort of started. We'll get into that a little bit later. But I just frame it up for the audience about a bit of your background, what you're into from a business perspective, mate.
So my name's Andrew Stotz, and I'm, first of all, the host of My Worst Investment Ever podcast, where I interview people about their mistakes that they made and their worst investments. I have 4 basic things that I do. First one is I have a coffee business that I'm co-invested in and co-founder that's been around for almost 3 decades here in Thailand. The second thing I do is develop investment strategies and help people manage their money. And then the third thing that I do is about valuation. I value companies. I've been doing that all my career. And as a side note, I have the valuation masterclass that I teach young people how to value companies. And then the final thing is I have a service called Outsource CFO. And what I found is a lot of small, medium-sized companies particularly struggle because they're so focused on getting revenue and building their business that they put the accounting and finance aspect aside. So what I help companies do is get on-time and accurate monthly financial statements and consistently, and then start to use those statements as a feedback mechanism to check their performance. So kind of, as I say, finance is a mirror, and I help get that mirror up and show it in front of not only them, but, you know, for me and my own businesses and what we do, we use that as a mirror. So I think that the main thing that goes throughout my whole life is my passion for finance. That's the thing that I've devoted my life to.
Yeah, mate, you're certainly well entrenched in that space and a leader, absolute leader in the financial area, particularly in Asia. I have to plug the podcast as well, mate. I was a guest on the podcast, I think back in like 360-odd episode or somewhere, 366,
366.
I think it was. Mate, you've done, did you remember that or did you check it before we came on?
366.
Mate, you are definitely an analyst, right? You remember numbers.
Yep.
Mate, it is a fantastic podcast. Absolutely. I love the structure of it and understanding people's worst investment, and the diversity of people you get on the podcast is fantastic. So, Culture of Things listeners, check out Andrew's Worst Investment Ever podcast. It's well worth the listen. Mate, going back to you being a leader in that financial area, one of the things that I guess in researching for this interview, you know, there's some things that have been paramount to you as a person, and this is what we want to unpack. You've got all sorts of experience, not just in the financial sector that you've just explained, and even coffee and service and delivery and valuation, but in life generally. You know, you've had some ups and downs like a lot of people, maybe in early life, you know, your trajectory in life could have gone different ways. So what we're really interested in unpacking today is these 10 things that I guess you've molded that make up you as a person and what you stand for and how you live your life and how you make decisions. So I found that super fascinating. And I want to start there. You've broken up into two parts. There was five that really focus on interactions with others, and there were five that focus on how you do your work. Can I start with the first part of how you interact with others? Super important. I know you value relationships. One of those first ones that came up was loyal. Tell us about loyal, what that means for you.
And maybe I'll just explain the backstory of where this whole thing came from.
Please do.
Too, which was, you know, I mean, I had been teaching ethics and I had been trying to live ethically. And I always felt like ethics is taught negatively. Like, here's a story of somebody that did something like broke trust, broke loyalty, did insider trading, and this is what happened to them. And I think that for a young person, they just may not be able to relate to that. And therefore, they're going to think, oh, that's not going to happen to me or whatever. So I decided, you know, why don't I flip it around and say that ethics can add value to you? Because even in the area of CFA, where I'm involved in for chartered financial analysts, I was teaching ethics. And I taught that way of kind of from a negative. And that's when I decided to turn it around, because I also saw that students didn't pay attention in ethics until the last minute. You know, they want to learn how to value a company or whatever. But I tried to say that actually, if you look at finance, accounting, and all of these areas, it's very hard to build a competitive advantage in, you know, Excel spreadsheet skills or coding skills or accounting skills or understanding a financial statement. Anybody can learn that. But what I try to teach people is that very few people build ethics into their life in a way that it can really add value. So the first part of that is I talk about how we can apply ethics in our interactions. And this, a lot of this comes from the CFA guidelines on ethics and then trying to bring that into my own life. So the first one is be loyal. And what that means is that you always put your clients' interests first. And if you do that one thing regularly and consistently, you're already adding value, because a lot of people aren't loyal. So that's my first one out of the five.
Well, I just want to unpack that loyal, because I think it's really relevant to attach, where it is relevant, stories to that loyal. So it's always these things that we value and the ethics and you talk about where you've come up, you know, they're generally based on experiences in our lives. What have you attached back to that experience of loyalty and why being loyal is important?
Well, what I see is that people get confused sometimes about where their loyalties lie. For instance, as an example, I was a sell-side analyst for many, many years, meaning I'm visiting companies kind of on behalf of fund managers who are around the world who want to know what's happening with these companies. So here I have a CEO that I'm talking to at company XYZ here, let's say in Thailand, and I got a fund manager back in New York that's trying to make a decision whether he's going to buy or sell. And, you know, I have an interest in trying to make sure that the CEO and I get along so that he's a long-term resource for me and all that. But sometimes I've seen people get caught up where they lose the aspect of where's their loyalty. And ultimately, in that situation, as a sell-side analyst, my loyalty is to my client, and my client is the fund manager back in the U.S. And as I work with young analysts and as I work with, you know, many people, I always ask, who is your client and what is your obligation of loyalty to them? And once you recalibrate to that, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, right. But sometimes when we have a lot of different things going on, we can get lost in that. But I think once you do that, it's also gratifying for the client when you say, my objective is to get the best information or the best deal for you. You are my client.
How do you live that in your personal life outside of the work that you do?
Well, I think that it's a good example is taking care of my mother, which my mother's 84 and lives with me here in Thailand. You know, ultimately, I'm the primary caregiver, and I can sit there and listen to a different doctor, a different nurse, and all that, and, you know, get mesmerized by what they're talking about. But the fact is that if it's not the right thing for my mom, so for instance, a doctor may say, oh, well, you shouldn't move a lot because you have a wound on your foot, as an example. But basically, that doctor's only looking at a small area. And my loyalty is to my mother's total health. And I can say if she stops moving, that's going to cause other problems related to blood flow, related to GI system and all of that. And so ultimately, I have to stand up for her rights and stand up for her situation and say, doctor, have you thought of this and that? And, you know, it's uncomfortable. I don't want to be confrontational with these guys, but that doctor and that nurse is not where my loyalty lies. It is with my mother as being the primary caregiver. So that's an example kind of in my personal life where I have to apply that.
And you do post on your Instagram account, which has a reasonable amount of followers, I have to say. Lots of photos of you and your mum out lunching all the time and stuff like that. So you seem to be enjoying yourselves together.
We have a good time together. And that's part of the reason why I keep trying to convince her to keep moving, because that's a luxury, is getting out to have a nice meal and all that. So, yeah. But imagine how my mom would feel if she started thinking that my loyalty wasn't to her. Wow, that would just be awful to think of how she would feel being here in Bangkok with me being the primary caregiver, and then I'm messing around and I'm not putting her interests first ahead of others.
Nice lead into the next one, trustworthy. Explain that a bit. And what you just shared, if trustworthiness is not there, and understanding what you just said about loyalty, what's the impact of those two?
The way that I think about trustworthiness is that people have no doubt that they can rely on your character, your ability, and your honesty. Now, think about trustworthiness for just a minute and ask for the listeners, the viewers out there, and for yourself, Brendan, is the question is, how many people do you truly trust in your life? What would you say?
If I had to count, I would probably say true trust would come on one hand, maybe venture into the other one slightly.
So I think that when I ask this question all over, you know, whenever I teach about ethics, the answer is probably on average 3. The high end is 5 to 7, and the low end is, well, the lowest I've heard from some people in the audience is 0. So let's just take 3. The first lesson I learned, there was a great book I read many years ago called Reality Therapy, and he talked about mental illness is really just the body's and the emotional reaction to the fact that you don't have anybody you can trust. And when you lose the ability to trust anybody around you, your body puts up a lot of defense mechanisms. So we really need to have at least one person that we trust to have full kind of emotional development. And I think that his theory about that, I think I took to heart, and I thought that was very insightful. So, but let's just take 3 for a moment. If there's only 3 people that you trust, but how many people do you know, right? Like people that you know that are acquaintances, maybe 100, maybe there's a lot of people in your social network, but generally you could say maybe there's 20 or 30 people that are close to you, and there's only, let's say, 3 on average that you trust. And that means that trust is rare. And right there is evidence of it. So then the next question I always ask, and I would ask for the people listening and viewing this, is the idea that if I was to ask a friend of yours, how many people do you trust? And they say 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or whatever, are you one of those people? So rather than, you know, think about it, who do I trust? You try to think about, how do I make sure that I'm building into my character trustworthiness? And I can think about one example is my business partner, Dale. We've been business partners for three decades, and we were friends from when we were 14. And not once in all of those years has Dale betrayed my trust. Like, I heard him talking bad about me, or someone says something, you know, like just anything. And I can say that I had the same experience with my family. And my dad, when he was towards the end of his life, I asked him what was his proudest moment. He said, "I built a trusting family." So trust is rare. Loyalty is rare. Trustworthiness is rare. If you just have those traits that you build into your character, you are valuable.
How do I become a person in your trusted circle? To use an example of, say, a relationship with you and I.
One of the things, you know, in this world of instant gratification, we have hacks and we have cheat sheets and we have shortcuts. But what's interesting about trust is it can really only be built over time, because you have to, first there's a basic trust where we start to get to know each other and we like each other. But then the trust really comes in of when times get tough, or when you know, in, and those times don't always come up that often, but it's that trust is built over time. So I would say that I'm a pretty, because I've had a good experience in my life with trust, with my family and close friends, I'm pretty willing to trust other people pretty easily. But I also know that the minute I get any signal of nonsense or untrustworthiness, I'm not interested in continuing. So really, for me, it's just about interactions, having more and more interaction, getting to know each other, and then trying to see, you know, what it's like. But once I am really, really tough on trust, if somebody was to break my trust in one way or another, particularly in the beginning of a relationship, nah. And that's why I think it's also hard. I had a guy that I got to know here in Bangkok, and it was about 10 years ago that we started spending more time together and talking. And I realized, you know, I could trust him, and we've had a good relationship. But I thought to myself, wow, it's been a long time since I've made a new friend. And that's because as we get older, we have some reality about the rare nature of trust.
On that point, do you think that over time, if we're not meeting and making new friends, that we can lose the ability to build the level of trust you're talking about?
Well, one good thing is, to me, trust is cumulative. So I have some friends that we've built trust over many years, and maybe we didn't talk for 5 years and then we connect right back. The trust is right at the level that it was before. So the good news is, when you invest in trust, you're investing in an asset that holds its value. So that's the best part, I would say, about it, you know. And then I guess from my perspective, once I've identified the people around me that I can trust, I just go all in with those people, and I share how I feel, and, you know, I know I can. So just last night I was, you know, facing some difficulties in my day and dealing with a lot of different stuff. And I just called Dale, my best friend, and basically said, look, this is what's going on. And, you know, it's that kind of the conversation I may not have with someone else, but with someone like Dale that I trust, I feel comfortable to have that conversation. So, you know, for the takeaway for the listeners is, number one, become a trustworthy person. And one of the easiest ways to do that is, do not speak about another person ever. So even to say, oh yeah, that guy, I know that guy, he's my friend, or, you know, we talked about this or that. Nope. Be very tight-lipped with the information. Now, I was the president of CFA Society in Thailand, which meant that people came to me with problems and also some ethical violations and other issues. And what I prided myself in was that when they talked to me about what was going on, I was able to be confidential in my communication. Now, of course, that's another one that we'll talk about in a bit, but trustworthiness is key.
Yeah, well said, mate. Let's go on to the third element of ethics and who Andrew Stotz is, what underpins him.
Yeah, so the third one is fair, and the way we interact with people to be fair. In fact, if you think about it, if you're ever called unfair, like you're an unfair person, oh, just cuts to the heart. You know, I mean, that is not what I want to be seen as, and say, yeah, Brendan, you're really unfair in the way you treat the people around you. Whoa, that's like a knockout punch. So I want to be fair. And what it means is that you deal fairly and objectively with all your friends, your clients, the people around you, based upon their needs. Now, in the world of finance, this is particularly important, because I may have found a great stock that I've done a lot of research on, and I think this stock is going to fly. And I may have 100 clients that I want to buy that stock. But if I basically went to the ones I liked the most, and I brought that idea to them first, and then I brought it later to the other ones. Well, that's not fair. And so what I learned about fairness is that, you know, we have to treat each person, you know, in a fair way. Now, we have a saying in the CFA world, which is fair is not always equal. So if a particular stock is not for the style of a particular client, I may, you know, think about, okay, it doesn't make, I don't need to disclose that. But I also feel like, you know, trying to think about the interests of the people around you and treating them fairly. Let's just say you have a small client, and then they feel like you're treating them just as much, just as fairly as you're treating a bigger client. You're going to have a client for life.
I guess this is why you've been so successful in your time and continue to create success around you, mate, because you're in this financial space, a very well-known financial analyst, and you're talking loyal, trustworthiness, and fairness. You must come up against some pretty challenging situations where those values for you are challenged often.
Well, you know, the one thing about building these ethical behaviors into your life and ethical actions is that unethical people don't talk to me. They know right from up front, don't bring me any bullshit. And so am I stopping bad behavior in the world? Well, as a supervisor of people, if I see it and I can get involved and stop it, I will. You could say, well, you're just pushing those people to another place. Well, if we all did that, you know, those people wouldn't have a place to go. And so I think that what you find is that developing a code of ethics and clearly communicating it, you know, like, let's just say that recently I have a new partner for a particular part of our business, that firm, I just went to meet with seven of them and one of me to go through the beginning of the relationship. And I just said, look, let's just start off with the fact that I was president of CFA Society and I've never had an ethical violation in my career. And the last thing I want to do is do something that would harm that. So let's start from that point that I believe you also want that too, right? And they're like, absolutely. Good. That's our starting point. And then that always allows us to have any conversation if something was to come up that seemed like it may be, you know, borderline or something to consider.
Andrew, I just want to sum that up a little bit. What's going through my head at the moment is that what I understand you're saying to me in slightly different words is that if you're very clear on what you stand for and that's always put out in the world, not necessarily, hey, here's my poster, but the actions that you portray each and every single day, then the right people will attract themselves to you. But more importantly, the wrong people won't even try and interact with you.
They'll see right off the bat, you know, there's not an opportunity here. And I have a thing
easier.
That I did. Yeah, it makes life easier. I had a chant or a mantra that I've said over the years, and that is, I want to be attractive. And what does that mean to be attractive? It means I attract good things and good people. And that really is my definition of attractiveness. And then I have mapped out some of the steps that if I was an attractive person, what would I be doing each day? And one of the things I said is all my words are positive. So that's my mantra. All my words are positive. All my words are positive. All my words are positive. So negative people don't have a chance around me. I'll never engage in negative gossip or other things. It's not to say that I'm a Pollyanna or saying everything's amazing and it's great. No, I'm willing to deal with any trouble that comes into my life, but I am going to speak in a positive way and use positive words. And that ultimately gives, because I remember many years ago, I was talking with them and I was telling them about that and they said, that's why I never heard you gossip about other people and complain. And I said, yeah, all my words are positive. And as I'm speaking about it right now, I'm thinking about that this morning I was complaining about something. And I'm just thinking, that doesn't fit. So I'm trying to get my mind so that I'm catching myself. And I'm just thinking about it as we speak. I was complaining about something related to my mom and what's happening with her healthcare. And, you know, ultimately, does that type of negative talk help? Probably not.
Well, I guess you're good, mate, but you're not perfect. We haven't found a perfect person yet, have we?
Well, I think that that's not what the goal is anyways. You know, I think being in the financial world also is, it's such a brutal world because you see right in front of, you know, you, if you're running a business and you're making bad decisions, you could potentially run that business for another 5 years or 3 years or 1 year or whatever. But if you're making bad decisions in your investment decisions in the stock market, the reality comes very quickly and very hard and very strong. And you can't ignore reality in the financial world. And that's why that's what I like about it. It could even be one of the last places of truth, or I wouldn't say truth, but where consequences are very real. If you develop a social opinion about society or the way a certain type of people should be treated or the way whatever your idea is, it could be just awful and cause awful consequences. But the reality is that in this world, you could go on for years with a flawed thought process, but the stock market will wake you up to that very quickly. And any listener out there that has lost money in the stock market knows exactly what I mean. Like, I love Tesla, I'm buying Tesla. Well, yeah, you may be very wrong in buying Tesla right now, or you may be very right, you know, we'll know.
What's your thoughts on Bitcoin, some of these cryptocurrencies?
One of my parts of my business is outsourced CFO. So I am actually a CFO of a cryptocurrency exchange where we've done a lot of the work on the back office and the finance and accounting and to make sure that that's done and that the company's in compliance. But I would say that my standard answer is 0 to 3% of your total wealth or total portfolio in crypto. If you don't feel comfortable with crypto, then zero. If you feel like I really want to bet on crypto, 3%. You know, maybe up to 5% if you really think that, you know, you're doing, you know, that you really know it. But, you know, it's not an asset class that has a cash flow to it. So it's a speculative asset class that you're hoping that there's a value there. And I know as a person who spent all my career trying to value things that there's a lot of different ways that people try to claim that there's value to Bitcoin or to other cryptocurrencies. But in most cases, I think they can break down when you really analyze it and say that really it is the value is ultimately that someone else sees something in it that, you know, causes the share price or the value to go up. And then you sell in that momentum and you capture some value of another person feeling like there's value, but it's very, very hard to measure.
Yeah, I understand, mate. We won't go down that path because I don't want to have to put any disclaimers on this interview about, you know, this is not financial advice or anything like that. We'll leave that to your episodes. Let's go into the next element of your five ethics around interacting with people, and that's confidential.
So the point is that in your interaction with clients, you want to protect the privacy of your clients. And what that means is like nothing ever leaks out about your clients from you. And basically, it's happening all the time. You know, people are showing off that they've got this big client or they're saying something of what that client disclosed to them. And in the world of finance, if on the sell side where I was a broker, basically the client may have a huge amount of shares in a particular company that they want to dump onto the market, but it's going to take them 4 weeks to do it because they got a lot of shares and they don't want the share price to go racing up because somebody leaks out to the market that there's this huge amount of shares. They want to be able to bring it out piecemeal if they can. And then they'll go out and they'll test different brokers. And they're doing this all the time where they're testing to see if something leaks from that broker. And I always say that, you know, ultimately, if you can keep it confidential, and as I say to people, particularly in the finance world, the best way to think about it is everything is confidential. So people ask me like, what is and what is not? Everything is confidential. So that's where the trustworthiness really builds is when you're a truly confidential person. The only thing that's not confidential is if a client, for instance, discloses that they've broken the law, then you have some obligation to society to deal with that, report that, talk to the client, that type of thing. And the only other time is if you are required by the government, where the government may say that you have to submit information, there's not a lot you can do about that. You're required to do that. You know, you could try to push back and say, please give me the exact information, the exact authority that you have to demand this information. Like, how about a warrant or, you know, something like that? Then, you know, that's the only other time. Now, there is other times when clients will voluntarily give up their confidentiality. Like, for instance, when we sign a credit card to get a credit card, we are saying that we are allowing that credit card company to release our financial records from the credit card company into, for instance, a country's database on that. But otherwise, generally keep everything confidential. So if you're loyal, you're trustworthy, you're fair, and you're confidential, wow, right there, just those four things will make you rare.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you just explained about the where it's okay to break confidentiality, I guess that leads into the fifth element of, you know, what you stand for in your ethics. You want to explain that one?
So this is reveal conflicts of interest, right? That you always disclose conflicts of interest before your clients make decisions. I give an example here in Thailand to my Thai students that say, imagine that the cabinet of the government is meeting and they're trying to decide on a new building that they're going to build for parliament, as an example. And they're looking at all these different land plots. And one of the members of the cabinet has a big piece of land and it's being considered as one of the land plots that they may build this on. And I ask them, you know, is that allowed under ethics? And they always say, no, that's definitely not allowed. And the answer to the question to that question is, absolutely, it's allowed. However, that cabinet member has to reveal the conflict of interest. If they don't reveal it, or they don't say, oh yeah, well, it's in my wife's name, but it's still mine. And then they usually would need to recuse themselves. They have to stay out of the vote, basically.
Yeah, okay, exclude themselves from the...
Yeah. So the point that I'm making is that a lot of people get confused and they think that our objective in society is to reduce conflicts of interest. But that's impossible. Every salesperson's making a commission. You know, everything out there has got conflicts. So what the objective is to reveal conflicts of interest before people make a decision. So if I'm being compensated by two different companies, for instance, for a particular mutual funds, they have mutual funds and these guys pay me 20% commission and these guys pay me 10% commission, it's important that I disclose that to the client. Once I've disclosed that to the client, if I say that I like the one that's paying a higher commission to me, the client has the information then to be able to make a decision. Nobody expects that conflicts of interest don't exist. But I had a case where I had not revealed the conflicts of interest in a particular case. And what I did is I went to the client after thinking about it and I just said, look, I didn't reveal this. And what I'm just going to tell you also is that I'm not going to take any fee on this particular transaction because I didn't reveal it to you in the beginning. So the point is, reveal conflicts of interest, put them out on the table. It simplifies everything. But, you know, there's always going to be conflicts of interest. So don't try to focus on eliminating conflicts of interest. If every conflict of interest was revealed, it's also something I've thought about corruption in Asia, which is so prevalent. And in some cases, it's really seen as a legitimate cost of doing business. And I felt like sometimes we fight so hard to say, okay, get rid of corruption, all that. Sometimes I feel like maybe it's better that corruption is allowed to be legal, but it must be disclosed. So if two companies are bidding and a company wins, and then they show, okay, we paid the guy at this particular company X amount and all that, you know, and we paid this and that, and then they list it out. It's legal. Do it. Go ahead. But it's got to be public. That would be enough for society to be able to control it. And the opposing forces of competition would also try to control it. So it's a weird idea for a guy that, you know, we would say I'm an ethical guy to say that we should make corruption legal. But I just, after 30 years in Asia, I would say the idea, it's a little bit like the war on drugs in America. The more they spent, the more they cracked down, the less that they actually solved the problem. They incentivized so many other things. And now we're 40, 50 years into the war on drugs in America and still no significant result. In fact, that whole problem is, you know, very serious. So there it is. Basically, if you're loyal, you're trustworthy, you're fair, you're confidential, and you reveal conflicts of interest in your interactions with others, you're going to be very, very rare. And the point is, rare is valuable. And in the world of finance, we know that for sure. So if you build those things into your life, the point that I would make is that, you know, your ethics is adding value to you. You're seeing the positive side of how we can apply ethics rather than a case studies of all the ethical mistakes that people made.
Our interview will continue after this. An expression of gratitude or reciprocity, no matter how large or small, is an important part of a healthy culture and relationships. Our friends at Jangler have a great app that allows you to send a gift card with either a personal video, voice message, or funny GIF. You can send it right away or schedule to send on the perfect day and time, so it can be something you set and forget. It's perfect for clients, employees, birthdays, and any celebration where you can't be there in person. It's quick, easy to send, and you can spend instantly in-store or online when you receive a card. Check it out at www.jangler.com.au. That's www.jangler.com.au.
Andrew, you speak about this with a huge level of clarity. Can you just explain to us some of the journey that you've been on to get to this unbelievable level of clarity around what you stand for in your interactions with others?
Well, I mean, you know, my story is about getting clean and sober at a young age, and I was forced to kind of deal with reality. I was forced to communicate directly and honestly through, you know, drug rehab, basically. And so that was kind of the beginning that got me realizing that putting my cards on the table, I had to do it or else I was going to go back to drinking and drugging and all of that. So I was kind of pushed to do it, and then I started to see the benefit of it. And then I started teaching ethics many, many years ago. I had to study ethics. I had to do it when I was working as an analyst. I had to do it when I was taking my CFA exam. But then I started to see this challenge. In fact, I saw the statistics of students in Thailand, and they were struggling with ethics in the CFA exam. So that's where I was thinking. And I always ask them, why do you think that, you know, that you scored poorly? And they say, well, ethics on the CFA exam's got a lot of English, you know, tricky English language stuff. And I was like, yeah, but you know, you're not the only non-native speakers who are taking the exam. They could be Spanish, they could be Chinese. And, you know, we went through a lot of different things, but I think the point is that most people just don't build a lot of clarity in that area. And I think ultimately it comes down to society, our parents in particular. And I would say that helping people understand that there's a line and helping people understand that ethics is not as ambiguous as people want to make it sound and seem. And a lot of times people are like, yeah, well, what would you do in this case? What would you do in that case? Once you build ethical principles into your life, many of those cases don't even come into your life, first of all. But then you just, you know, I went into a job, for instance, where in this particular company, the research team writes research, and when it's done, they release it to the world. And then there's a sales team that sells that research. The sales team is not supposed to know what that research is until the same time the rest of the world knows. And that is fair disclosure. But what happened when I came in as a head of research, the salespeople asked me, hey, what are you going to publish next week? And I said, well, I can't discuss that. And they said, well, we used to be able to discuss that with the head of research before. And I said, look, that's an ethical violation. And I'm telling you right now, I will not do it. And it's going to stop right there. And then I talked to my boss and just said, look, this is what came up. I can't control what happened in the past, but I can tell you that is an ethical violation and therefore I won't do it. And he said, thank you so much. And it stopped right there. So I would say that, you know, ethics is not as gray as it appears. Now, the problem that you face is that some people get up on a high horse and they're like, no, I don't want to allow anything. And that, you know, you need to discuss it, bring it out, just like revealing conflicts. Discuss it with your boss, discuss it with other people, and then try to come up with, you know, a black and white.
I want to go back to, I know you've just mentioned the story, again, not so much the story about the, you know, how you got into drug and alcohol and all that sort of stuff, but your journey through. I know from learning about you, your parents were a big part of helping you through that. How much of that connection with your parents, and then even what you're doing now in the caring of your dad previously before he passed away with your mother, how much has that experience alone shaped you and those ethics and your unbelievable passion and so much commitment to what you're about?
Well, I think it's key. And I didn't realize how valuable it was, but I think now I've come to realize that there's a lot of people out there that don't have a North Star. And I don't think my parents ever talked to me about ethics or about my character or anything. It's just that they demonstrated through their behavior what's right and wrong and what to do and what not to do. And I knew when I was doing wrong, I knew it was wrong. And so I would say that it was just by example, really. They never really, you know, pushed me in any one way or another. You know, I think even if we take away the drug and alcohol use, plenty of the listeners and viewers are struggling, you know, they're struggling in their lives on different issues. And what I learned is that if you can face an issue head on, try to identify it, talk to people, get help with it, and then try to get through it. I think the only way through problems in our lives is through them. And when you go through them, you come out the other side a better, stronger person. And I think that that's, you know, the main thing is just when you're facing situations, just talk about it and find those people that you trust and talk about it. So I would say that in my family, we were always open. And, you know, Brendan, here's a funny story. When I was in LA, I was surrounded by Cambodian families, Asian families, and all of us guys, you know, the certainly a Midwest guy from Ohio living in California thought, wow, these families in Asia are really close. Yeah, I'd see them dropping off each other and sharing the car and helping each other. And then I moved to Asia and I found out I was wrong. Asian families are not as close as I thought. What I learned was that they're physically close, but not emotionally close. So they're definitely helping each other in many different ways. But in general, it's hard for the young kids to talk to their parents, particularly their fathers. And they just can't share a lot of stuff with their mom and dads because their mom and dads don't understand it or won't, you know, take the time to listen to that. And that just was real revelation to me. And then I realized how valuable my relationship with my parents were, because no matter what bad thing that happened in my life, I shared it with them. And, you know, I lost a job at one point in my life and it was a little bit of my problem. And but really I was kind of, some people were coming down on me pretty hard and it was a tough time. And somebody asked me when they talked about it later, like, what did you do? I said, I called my mom and dad. And I said, it was really one of the harder calls I had to tell them, you know, because of what happened. And they were just shocked that I would even talk to my mom and dad about it. So I would just say, from a parent perspective, listen to your kids and talk to your kids and ask them how they feel. And from a child perspective, do your best to try to talk to your mom and dad about your feelings, and hopefully that works. But if it doesn't work, then, you know, look for other people that you can talk to about the things that you feel.
Yeah, love that, mate. And it's certainly something my wife and I have tried to live with every day with our own children. And they're 22 and 19 now, and I don't think there's any subjects they don't talk to us about. We have a very open communication line and the challenges they have as young people, and vice versa. We talk to them a lot about sort of learning younger people and experiences and what works. So I couldn't agree more. On that point of ethics and differences in cultures more so, because you have trained and have interacted, taught even through your lectures and stuff, so many thousands of people, and particularly young people as well, across the divide of the world. Let's just focus on East versus West to some extent, and maybe you've shared a little bit. What's the key challenge or the key challenges you've seen in those different East and Western cultures related to ethics, those variations that may come up?
It's a challenge. You know, I would say that there's a lot of people in Asia that are brought up to think that, well, corruption is just a natural thing. And that's where I also feel like one of the successes that I've had in living in Asia is try to take off the hat that I have of the way I was brought up and what I think is right and wrong, and try to put yourself into the shoes of these other people who were brought up with something very different. That is really the biggest challenge, because what someone may look at China and say, well, that's not good, that's not right. Well, just as much China could say the same thing about, you know, that's not good, that's not right, about America or Australia or any other country. And one of the hardest things is to break your mental model or the framework that you have. So I think the first thing is to understand that, you know, we come from different angles. And you can also say that what is ethical versus unethical for different cultures could be different. Now, the good thing about ethics in relation to CFA is that CFA is trying to kind of standardize ethics in the world of finance. So when I'm teaching ethics in the world of finance, I can say, look, you signed up for this code of ethics as a candidate to become a CFA charter holder. And so let's understand what they are and let's understand your obligations to find them. And I've found that what I say to some of my students when they say, I see corruption or other things happening, and I basically say that now you have your excuse. You can say, oh, I signed an agreement that I wouldn't violate ethical principles of CFA Institute, and therefore I just can't, you know, I can't do anything about what you guys are talking about, and then separate yourself from that. And so, you know, that's where I think there is some ethics principles and all that can be very helpful, particularly for young people. And I do get calls from my students, you know, who bring ethical dilemmas, and then we talk about, you know, what they could do. And sometimes they get really worked up when it may not actually be as big of a violation as they're thinking, but they're so, you know, convinced. So there's a discussion there always.
And that's really the great thing, isn't it? As you said earlier, like being able to come to someone that they've got a level of trust, or a group of people that level of trust, and put these things out on the table and have a really adult type conversation around it. Maybe that's something that should happen around the world more so generally, and we wouldn't have the problems that we seem to have.
Yeah. Well, requiring people to talk is, you know, making it happen. I mean, right now we have the beginnings of World War III happening. And it can be stopped right now, particularly if the U.S., which has 10 times the military might of Russia, says, let's sit down and talk. But they're refusing to have any communication. And therefore, we're heading into an awful situation that could be stopped today by sitting down and talking.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Conversation is key in anything, the ability to communicate and not judge, but be curious and understand, I think is what you're saying. Mate, let's go on to the next five, which round out the 10 that you have around your values and ethics. So these sit around more how you do your work. You want to start with your first one?
So the first one's diligent, right? That you want your client to know that you persevere in the application of your knowledge and skills. You know, you are diligent. And I remember having I had two analysts that I had hired, and they were working with me, and we went to the U.S. from Thailand to market our latest research. And one of those analysts was a very diligent guy. And every question that the client asked, he had an additional slide, or he had thought about it. And the other one didn't have anything. You know, he says, I'll get back to you. When I get back to Thailand, I'll get you an answer and all that. Now, which one would you rather rely on? You know, I think it's pretty clear. I want to know that this guy's thought this thing through. He's thought about the different aspects of this. So again, diligence is an important ethical principle. If you are diligent in your work, people will appreciate that and they will see value in that.
And it's maybe appropriate to quickly link that back to the first ones about your interaction with others, because that also, straight away I'm thinking, well, I wouldn't trust the second guy as much I would trust as the first guy.
Exactly. And I think that a lot of times people look for shortcuts, or they're tired, or, you know, they don't have enough time. And so they may skimp on diligence. But if you're really good at diligence, you're going to be rare for sure, because many people will just take shortcuts. So what, again, looking at ethics from a positive perspective, if you don't take shortcuts and you're diligent, that's going to show and you're going to stand out.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, all of these add up to rare people, because they're not as common as maybe what we'd like them to be.
Yeah, for sure.
Independent is the next one.
So the next one is being independent. And I find this really a fascinating one, right? The point is that you're not subject to the control of others. You don't look to others for your opinions or for guidance in your conduct. In other words, you make your own independent decisions. Now, in order to make independent decisions, we need tools. So CFA and things like my valuation course that I try to do, I tell the students that what I'm trying to do is bring you tools. Then you got to apply those tools. If you don't have those tools, it's hard to make independent decisions. So for instance, I have the ability to analyze academic research. So when COVID started happening, I started getting as much academic research about the medical aspect of it as I could. And from that, I was able to form independent ideas. Now, not everybody has that skill or even the time or the desire for that. So if you have those skills and if you have the time and desire, then, you know, you owe it to society to try to make an independent judgment, because many people just can't do independent judgments on many things for various reasons. And I don't do independent judgments on things that don't interest me also. But where I can do an independent judgment, then that's critical. And also I tell my students that just because you're independent doesn't mean you have to oppose what others say. It means that you have done your own research to analyze it and have come up with your own independent decision. So I always tell young people in the finance world, I said, you know, mostly in Asia, people are very dependent on their peers and on their seniors. And if you think about it, let's say Western cultures are try to teach to be more independent. In Asian cultures, it's less of a valued trait. So I say, you know, consider this your Independence Day. And ultimately, it's the independence of your mind that we're talking about. And once you reach that, where you have the tools and you have the desire to independently analyze things, then you open yourself up to a whole nother world, in my opinion. And so that's true independence. And again, independence doesn't mean that you oppose. Independent means that you come up with your own opinion based upon your own research or work. And that's why what I love about being an analyst is, as I tell my students all the time, is that in the Valuation Masterclass, I tell them that the thing about an analyst is we are idea originators. So we're trying to originate ideas and we're trying to think about things independently. So that's the concept of independence.
Being independent in the type of work that you're doing and that you're teaching, there does seem to be maybe the opportunity for some more black and white stuff, you know, some clear lines in the sand. But is there really true independence in life? And particularly with someone like you who has a very high value on the quality of relationships that you have. How can true independence come in when there's, you know, stronger relationships than others and maybe the information coming from those stronger relationships than others?
Well, I think the influences that we have in our life are constantly, I would say life is constantly trying to persuade us. You know, there's a billboard out there that's saying, buy an Android phone, not an iPhone. And there's another one that says, buy an iPhone, not an Android phone. That is persuasion. And it's trying to persuade us to go on one side or the other. And everybody has their agenda. Everybody has their angle. Everybody has their narrative. And so the challenge really, and it's a difficult challenge, the challenge is to search out other opinions. Because you can't make an independent decision if you've only listened to one side of a story. And I think about, you know, my mom listens to a certain number of podcasts, and they're generally all in the same narrative, and they repeat the narrative over and over. It's hard for her to even imagine that there's another narrative. And I would say that she's comfortable with that. She doesn't want to explore that other narrative for whatever reasons, you know. So, and I think that most people don't really want to explore other narratives. And that's why most people aren't analysts. Most people aren't independent. Most people aren't striving for that. But if you want to be a great analyst, you have to keep in mind that if you're following the crowd in this stock market, you're going to get burned eventually. And if you're the analyst that's calling to fund managers and you're talking about the latest thing and the latest news, the latest movements in the markets and what everybody's saying, what value are you? You're just repeating the news. And I can get that from, you know, the internet or whatever. But if you're someone that calls to the client and says, hey, I've been thinking about something, and, you know, for instance, to give an example, I've been thinking about we're heading into World War III, and we're going to stumble into it because what's going to happen is that countries are going to start falling, whether it's Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Tunisia, Kenya, Nigeria. These countries are going to run out of food, and their currencies are devaluing, and inflation is running rampant. And all of a sudden, we're going to find ourselves in a very hostile environment. And then that's going to be escalated by what's happening between the U.S. And therefore, the position that we're holding in commodities right now, which is right now about 25% of our overall portfolio, which we've held for about a year since the Fed said that the Fed chairman said they thought that inflation was transitory, we took a different view. I took a different view and said, no, I see enough evidence out there that I'm willing to say that's not transitory. So we took a heavy weighting position in that. And now I'm taking a consideration that it just could be that we've got 3 to 6 to 12 more months of further rises in commodity prices. And these are some of my ideas about why, some of the evidence. And that's the type of thing that a fund manager or an investor or a high net worth client wants to hear. So again, independent analysis is rare, and rare is valuable.
It also sounds a bit like, to me, how you've explained it, that that independence can come through in the My Worst Investment podcast and the thinking around that. You're not just looking at the rose-colored glasses side of investing. You're getting the opportunity to attach yourself to people and share real stories. Look at the other side is what you're saying.
Exactly. We need all the tools we can get in this life. And, you know, I had a transaction with a particular property a while ago, and my assistant who works with me said, we can do the legal paperwork ourselves. It's pretty straightforward. And I said, nope, hire a lawyer, hire the lawyer that we've used before that's really good at this. And she's like, no, but it's expensive. I said, look, after interviewing all these people, I know that you think it's expensive up front to hire a proper professional to help you do something. But in the long run, you're going to be saving yourself a lot of trouble. And basically, I was able to go to the seller and say, communicate with this lawyer. And basically, what happened was that the lawyer had so many different things they went through with the seller eventually kind of ran away. And so it was just particularly in that case, the buyer ran away, and the end result was the deal didn't go through. But if we had dealt with it, you know, who knows how long we would have messed around with that. So yeah, I just love the fact that I'm learning through, you know, the mistakes of others. Because Otto von Bismarck says, only a fool learns from his own mistakes. A wise man learns from the mistakes of others.
Yes, and hopefully we learn from the mistakes of others before we've made those mistakes.
Correct.
Let's move on to objective.
Yeah. So objective basically means that you deal with facts or conditions as you see them without allowing some distortions that are happening from, let's say, your own feelings about something, your prejudices, your interpretations, or your clients. So it's interesting that a couple of just before the November, or just before the presidential election, about 6 months before, I wrote a research report and went out to my clients, institutional clients. And I said, there's a 60% chance that Biden is going to win the election in the US. That's my calculation based upon, now let me walk through the way I came to that. But the first thing it says, so you support Biden? I said, it doesn't matter who I support. We're trying to predict the market. We're trying to predict outcomes. And so therefore, I've got to separate my feelings from whether I'm pro or con this. And this is very, very difficult. I was just talking with my students in the Valuation Masterclass Bootcamp, and they said, well, what if I don't like this company? And, you know, right from the start, I said, then you're not doing real research, because real research is you don't make your buy or sell decision until after you've done your research. And so being objective means stepping back and trying to gather information. And I think one of the best ways to be objective is to talk to both sides of the story. And I really like that. And that's where I find, you know, some people, they don't like the Twitter because it's just, you know, it's just a lot of banter. But the fact is that it's a great source to find the other side of the story. And when I think about the other, I have to think about it very carefully, because so let's just say that I'm 25% weighted in commodities, and I'm missing the story that no, inflation is going to start to fall, and that commodity position is going to fall significantly. If I'm not thinking of that and testing that and all that, I'm not ultimately loyal to my client. So that objectiveness is really because we want to be loyal to ourselves and to our client.
Before we go on to the last two, mate, I just want to circle back around actually before we started recording and ask you about the masterclasses. You said that, you know, there can be about a 30% drop off of people going through the masterclass and the 6-week bootcamp, really intense stuff. How much of that drop off can be contributed to one or several of these ethics that people don't have?
I would say that diligence is one. Independence and independent thinking is another, because what's happening is that many people say, I can't come up with a story. I don't know how to analyze this. Like, I know how to use Excel and I know how to. So I actually have lessons about how do you come up with a story. In the case of a company, I try to give them some framework such as, well, the story is probably going to be revenue, costs, or capital. If we look at revenue, you could break it down by price times quantity. If we look at Tesla as an example, it's really a quantity story. They're not going to be able to increase the price of their cars, but they want to grow the number of cars that they're selling by 10 times in 5 years. So it's a revenue story and it's a volume story. Facebook, on the other hand, has, my calculation is, almost an 80% market share of all the eligible people in the world. So it's unbelievable how much quantity that they've achieved, but the price that they're getting from the average user is very low. And so that's a story of how do we get more price increases out of the current user base. So a lot of what I try to do is say, no, you can come up with your own analysis, but you've just got to take it kind of step by step. But I would say that independence, you know, is part of what you're trying to do. So a framework can help a lot with independent.
Let's go on to the fourth, mate, thorough. And just reminding people, this is related to things in how you do your work, this part of the what Andrew Stott stands for.
Yep. So we said diligent, independent, objective, and then thorough. And basically, that means that you are careful about details and you complete your work in all respects. So diligence means that you're working hard to try to uncover this, but thorough means that you really have done your homework. And I would say this one really will make you rare, because most people don't do the job completely. And the result of that is that you can see it, you can feel it, that it's not something that clients want to rely on. So when they know that you're thorough, and think about it, if you think about a friend of yours that you know is a really thorough guy, when that person, man or woman, comes to you and says, hey, I've recently been looking at something and this is my conclusion on it, you know that's pretty reliable. I don't have to analyze everything. You know, if I have a friend of mine that's really thorough in the way they look at nutrition, I don't have to become an expert in nutrition if I can find someone that I know who's thorough in what they're doing. And if you combine in that they're diligent, they're independent, they're objective, then, you know, that is a very rare person. So, and then of course, the capstone of all of it is the fifth one, which is continually improve. And I find that majority of people hit a plateau and then they stop learning. And why not? You know, hey, come on, life's hard. I've worked hard to get to where I am. I don't want to have to keep working hard. I want to just live a simple, steady life on what I have learned. But I don't want to keep learning. I want to get the benefit of my prior learning. So I think it is very understandable that people don't want to necessarily continually improve. And or why not be in an environment where you're not under that pressure? But if you're in an environment, you know, where you're under that pressure, then continually improving to me is, you know, fascinating. I mean, I've probably, my estimate now is I've read 5,000 books in my life, and I've got 700 books right here in my library at home in my office. And people ask me, young people say, you know, have you read any of these books? And I've read all of them.
Maybe now's the right time, just so that people can see that they are real books. Just lean back and grab one so it's not a fake background that we've spoken about. Yes, it's real.
That's real. Yeah.
And you didn't even grab your own books.
No. My books are good, but, you know, there's just so much great stuff out there.
Isn't there?
Yeah. So continually improve is the final one. So to sum it up, right, if you're loyal in your interactions with others, you're trustworthy, you're fair, you're confidential, and you reveal conflicts of interest, your interactions with others are going to be awesome. And if you are diligent in the way that you work, and you're independent in the way that you work, and you're objective and thorough, and you continually improve, you are super rare person. And that level of focus or investment in ethics is going to make you very rare, and rare is very valuable. And you don't have to worry about marketing and all that, because people want to come and talk to you. People want to recommend you to other people. So that's really summarizes the 10 ways that ethics adds value in my life. And I believe it can add value in anybody's life. And I would say it's probably the simplest, easiest way to differentiate yourself in this highly competitive world. Someone may say, oh, I don't know how to program and I don't like numbers, and fine. This is the way to differentiate yourself, that anybody could do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd even say to people that, you know, if you have never thought about, you know, articulating your own value sets and, you know, some of your experiences you had, then this is almost a, you know, I'm never a big fan of these plug and play things. You know, you have to attach them to yourself. But if you wanted to try and be a better person, and in your words, rare in whatever you do, then I have to say this is a pretty damn good model to understand what you've said today through listening to this episode, and then apply it in the context of your own life or your own industry. You'll be rare in whatever you do. Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, let's give credit where credit's due. I was introduced to this code of conduct and standards of practice, you know, 20 years ago from CFA. And someone may also be an architect and into the world of architecture. Well, I'm sure they have a code of ethics there, you know, and look at what's around you and try to find that code of ethics, and you can use that. And that may be even more applicable. But in my case, this one was really applicable. And when I started teaching it, I started coming up with a positive framework, and that positive framework really helped me to reinforce it in my life.
When I look at the two sides of the equation, I suppose, the interaction with others and the how you do your work, it's sort of the interaction with others to me fits more with character of the person, and the how you do your work fits a bit more into competence. Now, that then to me equals a level of trust. Character and competence are key elements of trust. Probably answering my own question or putting it out there, can you have one side of the coin and the other, and have a level of trust and the quality of relationships that you need to have to be successful in business?
I guess as a formula, I wanted to be as valuable as I could. So practicing all 10 of them, you know, was valuable to me. I think that if I had to choose one side, I would choose the interactions with others. And I would say that build those into your characters, because, you know, not everybody is independent. Not everybody wants to be independent and objective. And people can exist in their lives and, you know, not being independent and objective. Not everybody wants to be thorough or diligent. It's just too much work. And I think that in a sense, you could say that there's a place for everybody, but you could still focus on your interactions, and you could still build the great relationships through the interactions. So I think when it comes to the way that we work or our competence, that's really the challenge of a lifetime for some people. But for others, they're like, no, I know enough. I've learned enough. I'm okay with that. But for me, those five elements of diligence, independence, objectivity, thoroughness, and continually improve is something that I've embraced. And I challenge anybody else that wants to build that to embrace it too. I think that one of my first jobs when I got out of high school, my father called a friend of his and said, hey, my son's looking for a job. You got a job at your factory. And so this was in Ohio. And I went to the factory, and there was four other guys, and we were all applying at the same time. And they said, well, the boss came in and he said, well, the way this works is you're going to work temporarily for 30 days. And if we like it, we're going to offer you a full-time job. You know, if we like you and you like it. So this one guy and I were, you know, we got to know each other. And the night before the decision date, he said to me, you know, what do you think? And I was like, man, I hope they don't offer me a job. This job is boring as hell. And I'm just sitting there working on a production line, and I'm thinking all the time. And, you know, I just want so much more out of my life than this. I said, what about you? And I never even really thought about that he would think differently than that. And he says, I really hope I get this job. And I was like, why? I want to be free of this. And he said, look, I like it. I know what I'm doing every day. I've learned, you know, my job. I go home to my wife and kids, and I don't have to think about work. And this is what I want. And sure enough, the next day, they let me go and they kept him. And what I learned from that interaction is that there's a place for everybody and everybody has different goals. And just because someone's made that choice to say, no, I'm not striving for this or that. No, I want it this way. It gave me a new respect. And then later I became a supervisor at Pepsi when I graduated from university. And I could see the workers in the factory and I remembered what I had experienced with that guy. And so I respected them for that choice. And I didn't expect that they're going to be continually improving. Of course, they have to do a certain amount of stuff to keep themselves doing a good job at work. But generally, I had a respect for them. And so I think that made me a better manager because I didn't expect that everybody was going to do it the way I was doing it.
Yeah, beautiful story, mate. And it just reinforces the fact we're all people, we're all unique, and we have different motivators and different value sets. What it doesn't do and say is that, you know, a person is good or a person's bad. Like, they're all good, just different values and different motivations. So, mate, let's lead that into the final question of our episode. And that is, who or what has had the greatest impact on your own leadership journey?
You know, there's a man that I don't remember his name, but he was economics kind of 101 professor at Kent State, where I first started going to university back in Ohio. And there was a classroom and there was 200 students. I'd never been in such a big classroom in my life. There was 200 students and I was sitting in the back, you know, and I arrived and he walked in and everybody got quiet. And he said, there's 200 people in this room. I'm going to draw a line down the middle and half of you will be gone by the end of this term. And of the remaining 100, 10 of you will get A's. Let's get started. And that one little statement set a fire under me to say, I'm going to get an A. I'm going to be part of that 10. And later that carried throughout my life. And I didn't feel that way when I walked into that room, but that man said something that really fired me up and I'll never forget it. And I just think that from a leadership perspective, just keep in mind that, you know, challenge people. In the boot camp, I challenge people. As I always say, the Valuation Masterclass boot camp is about transformation, not information. This can be a life-changing event in your life, and you can make friends for life in this boot camp. And this can be a time that you turn yourself around. And that inspirational message or that challenge is just what some people need. And so, you know, I think that's kind of one of the things that I would say from a leadership perspective is challenge people to be better, to be stronger, to be faster, to be smarter, to be kinder, whatever. And don't be afraid to put that challenge out there.
Andrew Stotz, you are a man who loves a challenge by the sounds of it. And after today, I knew before today, but our listeners are going to know after listening and watching this episode today that you, my friend, are truly a rare breed. Thank you for being a fantastic guest on the Culture of Things podcast.
Thank you for having me on, Brendan. I really appreciate it. And thanks to all the listeners and viewers.
Andrew believes ethics are rare, and rare is valuable. I have to say, I agree with him completely. Andrew is a rare breed. He lives and breathes his ethics every day, which is why he's valued so much by his clients, his students, and his mum. His words gave me inspiration in relation to leadership. The fact is, great leaders are rare, which means great leaders are valuable. Do you want to be a valuable person? These were my three key takeaways from my conversation with Andrew. My first key takeaway, leaders are ethical in their interaction with others. Being loyal, trustworthy, fair, confidential, and revealing conflicts all speak to a person's character. If you're clear on the character traits of the leader you want to be and apply these in your daily life, personal and business, you'll be a leader who is ethical in your interaction with others. My second key takeaway, leaders are ethical in how they do their work. Being diligent, independent, objective, and thorough, with a focus on continuous improvement, all speak to a person's competence. If you're clear on the traits you want to follow to demonstrate a high level of competence and apply these in your daily life, personal and business, you'll be a leader who is ethical in how you do your work. My third key takeaway, leaders know ethics is their competitive advantage. Almost every leader I've worked with over the years has not yet articulated what they stand for. They don't know how they want to lead, or the ethics they want to lead by. Getting clear on your ethics as a leader is rare, and rare is valuable. That's why leaders know that ethics is their competitive advantage. So in summary, my three key takeaways were: leaders are ethical in their interaction with others. Leaders are ethical in how they do their work. And leaders know ethics is their competitive advantage. If you want to talk culture, leadership, or teamwork, or have any questions or feedback about the episode, contact me at theculturethings.com or via our socials. Thanks for joining me, and remember, the best outcome is on the other side of a genuine conversation. Thank you for listening to the Culture of Things podcast with Brendan Rodgers. Please visit brendanrodgers.com.au to access the show notes. If you love the Culture of Things podcast, please subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts. And remember, a healthy culture is your competitive advantage.